Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August the 26th, 1995. In the fireside room this morning, our speakers are David and Kathleen Hurty. Their subject, Sharing Hospitality, Frontiers of Partnership. Let's listen in.
My name is Kathleen Hurty.
And my name is David Hurty.
And today's session is going to be on sharing hospitality, the frontiers of partnership. Obviously, there are many frontiers of partnership, and we'll talk about a number of those. But our hope is today that we will be able to focus with you on understanding hospitality as mission and ministry, and hospitality as well as a mutual process of giving and receiving. A lot of giving and receiving goes into the sense of hospitality. Behind what we're saying today are some key questions, and hopefully these are the questions that we'll keep in mind. Part of what we want to understand together in a teaching, learning kind of session is, how do the scriptures portray hospitality? What is it that we can learn from a scriptural basis about hospitality? And how do these understandings and insights shape our understanding in the way in which we live today in a hospitable way? So that's kind of the framing questions, as well as the scriptural understanding of hospitality as a mutual approach, both giving and receiving. Let's just for a moment,
if you have a Bible,
but of course most of you have scripture well embedded in your mind, so you can remember some of the images of hospitality in scripture. What comes to your mind as some of those early images of in both the Old and New Testament of hospitality?
Mary and Martha preparing for the coming.
All right, Mary and Martha. The Mary and Martha story is a marvelous way of expressing hospitality through the preparation for a meal and the preparation for conversation around that meal, both of which in which there was going to be, as they assumed, a lot of give and take. Other examples of hospitality.
Abraham and the angels.
I think that's this Genesis passage. Abraham and the angels.
How about Moses? Do we have that in the Bible, or is that extra biblical stories?
Moses?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Moses. Tell us more about your understanding of hospitality from Moses.
Well, I've just heard stories.
And
they seem to just grow around the person of Moses.
I think
most of them are apocryphal, but they're delightful.
Well, Moses, I suppose you could almost say, in terms of his own life, mm-hmm. was greeted or received by, you know, the Egyptian Pharaoh's daughter, and lived in a very hospitable condition, and then also his concern for the well-being of his own people. It shows a kind of a sense of mutual hospitality there.
And here, Moses and Abraham inviting the angels in. We, by the way, picked only a few here. The richness of hospitality imagery in the Bible is just very, very full. Other suggestions?
This is stretching it a bit, but God feeding the children of Israel both morning and...
Sure.
Right, exactly. In the desert wanderings,
yeah.
You're thinking
right.
of. Yes, the manna stories, and certainly hospitality on the desert is a key theme. Desert places can still be hospitable places. Other stories.
The woman who washed Jesus' feet.
Pardon? The woman who washed Jesus' feet.
With her tears?
Mm-hmm.
Who anointed him with oil?
Pardon?
Who anointed him?
With oil.
Right.
You know.
Depending on whose version you read.
Right. Washing and anointing and...
And again, that sort of showed a bit of hospitality on her part, and the person who, the house in which he was, mm-hmm. hadn't really taken care of that factor, which
right.
was a common responsibility for the host in a culture of that day. Mm-hmm. Just like in Abraham's situation, I mean, the guests that came to visit him, the three mysterious guests who came, in a desert climate, in a situation like that, to stop and have food and nourishment and water was very essential. And so that was kind of part of the cultural expectations that people would be greeted with hospitality.
The Emmaus disciples.
The Emmaus disciples that walk along the road to Emmaus, inviting Jesus in, the stranger they didn't know at the time. And it was in that mutual giving and receiving of hospitality that they became known to each other. A wonderful story of hospitality. The Leviticus story is one in which the story is one of a stranger as a native among you. Do you want to read the Leviticus passage or someone?
Okay, well, here I'll read it from this. The passage here is the one, when a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall do him no wrong. The stranger who sojourns with you shall be to you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. Or that's a sexist language, I know. But it is a fundamental. We use that at Seafarers International House as our basic premise from what we do.
And then, of course, the story of the Last Judgment, in as much as you have been hospitable, is one possible translation to the least of these, you have been hospitable to me, or in as much as you have loved, served, helped, and so forth. Mark 2:16. Somebody want to catch that real quickly? See what that has to tell us about hospitality. From your memory, of course. Let me read that for us.
And the scribes and the Pharisees, when they saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, said to his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?"
Okay, what does that tell us about the generosity of Christ's living together with others? A hospitable.
He wasn't prejudiced, he just was willing to eat with
openness, without prejudice, right. The Luke story is one that's common to all of us, the Last Supper. Again, the strangers helped provide that. Someone had a way into that meal in the upper room where food was available and provided, and the interaction of Jesus and his disciples in a context of being hosted.
The wedding at Cana.
And the miraculous things that happened in Cana, out of ordinary elements of food and making guests feel welcome, changing water into wine, those wonderful stories of hospitality. Well, we can together, we can think of many, many images of hospitality. The idea of welcoming the stranger is very clear in the biblical story. Henry Nouwen, or Henri Nouwen, if you pronounce it in the French way, has a book called Reaching Out, The Three Movements of Spiritual Life, in which he talks about the idea of guest and host and the interrelatedness of being both guest and host. And if you plow deeply into some of these scriptural stories, that imagery of guest and host, you learn from each other, is very much a present piece. The book is checked out in the library now, so I was unable to bring it in, but you might want to check that if you're going to be here for a while. And certainly it's available in your home libraries too. And then Parker Palmer also has a wonderful book on called The Company of Strangers. This is from the library here, and I'll turn it in so others can enjoy it too. But here, Parker Palmer is talking about Christians and the renewal of public life. And he's talking about the whole idea of the stranger among us as our spiritual guide, that we learn to find out more about ourselves by welcoming the stranger. And he has a wonderful phrase in here, a wonderful comment in here. Marked the wrong page, I guess.
Isn't that where your card is?
That's where my card is, but that's not the spot that I was looking at. Let me look at the other one, which is on page 70, which will illustrate it too. Pardon?
There.
Oh, yeah. In all these ways, the stranger of public life becomes the spiritual guide of our private life. Through the stranger, our view of self, of world, of God is deepened and expanded. Through the stranger, we are given a chance to find ourselves. And through the stranger, God finds us and offers us the gift of wholeness in the midst of our estranged lives, a gift of God and a gift of public life, living in community together with strangers, welcoming them in. Dave and I had a very interesting experience when Dave was serving a parish in Oakland, California. The English as a Second Language Institute was right across the freeway from our church. And one of the young students came down to our church to see if he could find a home to live in for the last, they had to stay at the dorm at the college for the first 2 months, but the last, if they could find a family to live in the last 4 months, they could live with a family and learn to speak English more. Well, he asked us to find someone. Dave tried to get someone in the church to do it. Finally, we said, well, we'll take him in. We had 4 kids at home at the time, and we said, well, we'll find room for one more. This young man was from Iran, and his dream was to study microbiology and genetics and go back and teach in Iran and help work with his people there. And he lived with us for those 4 months, then went on to graduate school at the university in Davis, which University of California, about 70 miles away, and he'd come back frequently. We learned so much from each other in those years. We have kept in contact for 20 years, and we have visited him in his home in Iran when he was studying there before the revolution, when it was easier to get in. He considered himself a Zoroastrian, but also had a great deal of knowledge about the Muslim faith. And we learned a lot from each other. And we found that we had to articulate what we believe more clearly and carefully in conversations together. It's been an enriching mutual sense of hospitality.
Well, it was interesting that he even came to church with us, right, and participated in Bible studies. I mean, we never put any pressure on him to do that, but he came with us and participated actually in our congregation. So
another starting point we're going to use is John Koenig's book, and David,
yeah,
you may want to
I might just
talk
call
about
attention
that.
To this. This book is also here in the library. This is my copy, but if it is in the library, if you're interested, it's not a real recent book, but it was published in, 85. But John Koenig teaches at the General Theological Seminary in New York City, which is the Episcopal Church's seminary there. John was a Lutheran, out of the Missouri Synod background, New Testament scholar. I think he married an Episcopal priest, a woman, and I think he's become an Episcopalian. But he has good Lutheran background and roots. Anyway, this book is very helpful if you're interested in getting some of this biblical perspective on hospitality. The way the book is designed, the first part is something of an introductory section where he talks about hospitality, strangers, and the love of God. And then he goes in and takes Jesus and Jesus' ministry and shows how hospitality was such a central part to the ministry of Jesus. And many of the stories here, many more things are brought out in his chapter on Jesus. And then he takes up Paul and shows how Paul's missionary ministry and the early church's ministry was also one that was really guided by hospitality in terms of mutuality. The wandering missionaries, you know, came into a city and they were given a place to stay by the small Christian community there, and there was a kind of a give and take in the early mission of the church in terms of spreading of the gospel. and that was a missionary endeavor. And then, of course, he picks up Luke and Acts and shows how in Luke and Acts there is so much evidence of hospitality as far as the early church's mission was concerned. So ministry and the mission of the church has always really flourished through the mission of hospitality, the ministry of hospitality, and it has been really central to that whole process. You might take note of these words up here, xenos, xenophobia, and philoxenia. He has an interesting paragraph on these words, and since he is the Greek scholar, I will just read what he has to say about this. In many of the encounters with strangers recorded by our New Testament witnesses, the roles of guests and hosts tend to reverse themselves or break down altogether. The potential for this fluidity is contained within the Greek language itself, for the noun xenos denotes simultaneously a guest, a host, or a stranger, while the verb xenizine means receive as a guest, but also surprise, and hence present someone or something as strange. Correspondingly, philoxenia, the term for hospitality used in the New Testament, refers literally not to a love of strangers per se, but to a delight in the whole guest-host relationship, and in the mysterious reversals and gains for all parties which may take place. So he's trying to suggest here that, the giving and the taking in the whole matter of being a host or a guest is something that's kind of a mystery. It's kind of the whole Christian mission is sort of a mystery at that point that we share with one another. So in that sense, he's speaking about how the Holy Spirit, in a sense, becomes central to the guest relationship and the host relationship with one another. You folks that work at the Compass Mission, I'm sure, have a kind of a sense of that, don't you? You learn and share and give and take.
Not only there, but you see it all around you, and that's where some of the real delight is. People that come in, bring their children, and they have a station wagon with fruit and sandwiches, and they park. And, it just happens on the street in so many ways. And that's some of the more delightful
aspects of it.
Yeah, right. The formal is great.
Sure.
They can count on that. But the special is kind of that picnic-like. That,
right.
Right.
Constant picnic.
Ruth, you had a comment.
Well, is xenophobia then the fear of the stranger?
Right.
Yeah, right. And that's a problem I think we're seeing become so dominant in our current world. Probably always has been around, but I think in Southern California, you're experiencing an awful lot of that, are you not?
Yes.
Would you want to say something about that?
Well, I just keep wanting to say to people, read your history books. Mm-hmm. Your Norwegian and Swedish and German ancestors did not come to this country and immediately learn the language. That's why we have First Lutheran churches, because the original name is First English Lutheran Church, or First Norwegian Lutheran Church, whatever. And that there really is a sense of the fear we're being taken over by people who don't speak the language, and why don't they speak the language, and get them off welfare. That was what Proposition 187 was, and of course 70% of the people in poverty are women and children. And so they're the ones who are being punished. People moving, a lot of moving in terms of school districts, and it's very powerful. Yeah. It's very painful.
The California Council of Churches, which is the policy arm of the Northern and Southern Ecumenical Councils of Churches, has been doing some very good work in trying to counter some of the fear, helping people to know by telling the stories of immigrants. Most immigrants come to this country wanting the same thing that our ancestors came to this country wanting, which was a safe place to raise family and to find sustenance for families, to live well. And so many of the immigrants in this country do all they can to avoid becoming on welfare, coming onto welfare, because they want to make it, and they're determined they're going to make it. They contribute, even from their low-wage jobs. Many of them have to take jobs that longer immigrants wouldn't take anymore. They take low-wage jobs, but they pay into the Social Security system in those jobs for many, many years before they reap the benefits of that Social Security system. And so they're helping to support the whole, even in that way. The California Council of Churches has joined with a number of other groups in California to open a suit against the state of California related to this proposition. And their argument is that the church's ministry of hospitality has always been one of open and welcome the guest and giving service to those who need it, and that the proposition flies against church-state relations because it robs, it's an interesting argument to be sure, it robs the religious community of doing what it is naturally able to do and to do well.
For example, for those of you who may not be familiar with it, in theory, anyone who cannot prove that they are documented to be in the country cannot receive any medical care beyond emergency care. Well, if we've got religious-affiliated hospitals,
then
it flies in the face of their mission statement and who they are.
Right. And schools, teachers are being asked not to serve students who have special needs.
And to report them,
and teachers are standing firm and saying, my faith, in many cases, teachers are saying, my faith will not allow me to turn this child away or to have to report this child for wanting to learn. It's a very complicated situation.
There are other sides to it.
Yes.
California is in a terrible financial straits because of the pressure of immigration. And this is coming out of frustration. And the answers just aren't there. I sometimes just see us all in a big world lifeboat. And I kind of not real optimistic it's going to stay afloat. It's just a matter of how many people you put in it, how fast the problem becomes almost unmanageable.
Uh-huh. Right.
We're just under so much stress there that these things are coming out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think part of the issue is that because our economy has been in the trouble that it's been in, and it has affected the wealthy people who benefited from the Reagan-Bush years, there is a looking for someone to blame. And I think that's the issue with affirmative action. And looking for someone to take the pressure off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the idea that these illegal immigrants are taking jobs, they're taking jobs that no one else will take. You know, the reason they're the ones that you see in the car washes is because white American teenagers won't take those jobs. And so I think that part of the issue of what's going on is that the terrible economic situation, which of course California is suffering immensely from because of the whole defense industry, in the same way in which California's economy boomed, and we need a place to blame it.
Right. So that the issue is one of, it's a frontier partnership. How do we live in the lifeboat together? Or how do we make sure that there is a way for people to live in nourished ways somewhere safe? And Southern California, I know, is feeling this pinch of overpopulation. Very hard. Well, there aren't easy answers. But the key issue is how then is the frontier of partnership with those who are coming into the country in new times? How are we hospitable then?
Especially as Christians, I think that's where we have to begin to ask ourselves the questions: are we as Christians going to go along with simply the cultural climate, or are we going to be a challenge to the cultural climate that is, against the stranger that's coming in, who is causing, seemingly causing, but you're saying that maybe they aren't really causing the problem either.
Well, I think it's a whole combination. I mean, another huge stress is when the North Ridge earthquake hit in the San Fernando Valley, the housing that was destroyed was by and large low-income housing. Mm-hmm. So there is a huge shortage of low-income housing. The homeless population continues to grow. I mean, there are so many factors that go into it, but I don't think it's as simple as saying it's the illegals.
Yeah.
Right, and the key to being on the frontier here, as a frontier of faith, is to ask ourselves then the questions, in this complex mess with its that we live in today, with economic situation and economic challenges, population challenges, certainly space challenges, certainly sociological challenges. Where do we find a sense? What is it that calls forth our sense of hospitality in each of these situations? And we could talk a whole hour on that one easily.
Well, their whole area of welcoming the stranger and the homeless.
In the homeless.
And you work primarily with people who are under what? Economic loss of job,
the whole gamut.
Yeah.
Domestic violence,
right.
Loss of job,
right.
Drug addiction, mental.
So here's an area of hospitality, both immigrants, homeless, and looking not only to serve immediate needs but root causes. What causes these situations to escalate and become, in many ways, problematic, is a constant challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Another whole area of hospitality that may be new to some of you is the area of seafaring ministry. And the seafaring ministry and international work that is done by Seafarers and Immigrants House is an illustration of hospitality.
Yeah, well, I could maybe share a little bit about that, because we have a tradition of that. At least in New York, I think even in Seattle, the Compass Mission originally was a seafaring ministry, was it not?
And lumber.
Anyway, but the ministry that I'm involved with now in New York is at Seafarers and International House, and originally it was started as a immigrant ministry. The particular Seafaring and International House that I'm involved with was started by the Augustana Lutheran Church and to the Scandinavians. However, they collaborated even in those early days of 1873 when it was organized with the Germans. The Germans also had an immigrant ministry. So there we even had a Lutheran cooperative ministry in the 1800s, 19th century.
Mixed marriage.
Yeah, right. And I mean, it shows that our ancestors were doing things even back then that made sense. And for 20 years, actually, the Scandinavian, the Swedish and Norwegian ministry was carried on together with the Germans. Eventually, the Seafarers International House did get a separate about two houses, which made it possible for them to have more accommodation for immigrants that were coming into the U.S. And then as the immigration subsided, they became more oriented toward seafarers and dealing with merchant seafarers, people who were on cargo ships and things of that sort. And through the years, that has been a major focus, working with the maritime community and seeking to help seafarers who come to New York. Now, this ministry is not limited, of course, to New York. That is, our ministry is, but we cooperate in a collaborative thing with other ministries around the world. There is an international Christian Maritime Association, which represents about over 700 ministries around the world, and I don't have enough of these to pass around, but it shows where many of the ports are where these ministries of the Christian Church are located.
What is it called?
The International Christian Maritime Association, and it's very ecumenical. It involves Anglicans, Episcopalian / Lutherans, Roman Catholics, And Southern Baptists here in this country have become very much involved in this ministry. And I think they're having a conference in Seattle this fall in September. And they have become really involved. The Presbyterian churches, but it's basically churches that have had a history of being maritime countries, like the Scandinavian countries, Germany and England. And members of the International Christian Maritime Association are Apostleship of the Sea, which is a Roman Catholic, and German Seamen's Mission, Norwegian Seamen's Mission. I mean, I could list all of them here, but basically they are, it's an international agency. Then in this country, or in North America, we have what is called the North American Maritime Ministry Association, which basically are all of the ports around the United States that have Christian ministries here in this country. And these organizations, or these port ministries, are basically what I would call workplace ministries. They are ministries in the workplace. We are dealing with an industrial kind of ministry. We primarily focus on the worker in that ministry, but that isn't limited to that. I mean, many of our ports attempt to work with the shipping companies, with the unions, the organizations that are all a part of the maritime situation. We are engaged primarily in promoting the welfare of seafarers and their families. And as a pastor dealing with seafarers that come to our center in New York City, I see some that do have seemingly good family relationships, that is, you know, homes where they can go when they come off board ship. But I also see many of them who have either lost ties with their family, alienated from their families, you might say, literally loners as far as their lifestyle is concerned. And they'll come and stay with us at Seafarers and International House because they have really no place else to go when they're off board ship. And they use our place as a home away from home. Yeah.
Do you think that this particular work attracts the loner, or do you think that they become?
To a certain degree, it probably does. In some cases, it has attracted the loners. I think that's part of it. And that's not limited just to the able-bodied seafarer. I mean, that's a person who isn't an engineer, isn't a radio operator, one of the officers on the ship. I even see some of the pretty highly skilled people on ships who can be loners too. I think of a fellow who comes to our house and stays there for weeks at a time. His sister was a member of my congregation in Oakland, and you know, if I hadn't kind of pumped it out of him, I would have never found that out. I mean, you know, I didn't realize this for several months actually after I had first met him. He's a Norwegian from North Dakota, went to sea as a young man. He's a skilled engineer. He is a man who has taken care of himself through the years. He has invested his money, you know, he doesn't come because he doesn't have any money to stay with us. In fact, he gives us grants. I won't give you his name, but he gave us $5,000 just this last month in order to improve the lounge in our building. So he's single. And he very seldom goes to visit his family. He does visit his family occasionally, but he's kind of a loner type. He's not really, I wouldn't call him alienated, but he's not closely related to his family. So we do have people like that. And we minister to them both pastorally. They come sometimes needing, you know, just to talk with someone and to be kind of affirmed, I guess you might say, as human beings, and we discuss with them their spiritual needs. Many times they have questions about their own spiritual lives and needs. I suppose our ministry tends to become more focused on their physical and human needs, just by the nature of the fact that we don't have, you know, long times to spend with them. But that's one of the concerns that we have, their welfare. And the chaplains that we have at Seafarers International House now go on board ship to visit with the seafarers and to sometimes bring things that they need and visit with them, partly because of containerization. I don't know if you know what containerization is, but nowadays the big containers are many times loaded in a factory, and then they are brought to the port and they are lifted onto a ship. So now a ship can come into port and unload and load within 8 hours many times. And so a ship is not in port very long. It used to be that a ship would come in port and be there maybe two, three weeks while they were unloading and loading. And in those days, in the centers like mine, or ours, would be needing a place for people to stay for more lengthy periods of time. But now it's important that our chaplains go on board ship and establish relationships with the crew during those short periods of time that they are in port. The Port of New York, the Port Authority, sends us, we have a fax machine, and every day we get a long sheet of the ship movements in the port, the ships that are expected to come and where they will be docked. And our chaplains look at that and decide which ships they feel they can have time to go visit. Now, there are other ministries in New York. We're not the only one. The Episcopal Church has a ministry and they have chaplains. The Roman Catholics have a ministry. So again, it's ecumenical. They serve the needs of some of the ships that come into port, and we serve the needs of some of the others. But part of our ministry is dealing with people who are strangers. And they are not always Americans. They may be Filipino. They may be people from former Yugoslavia. People of that sort that come and are a part of our world. So we reach out. And it's interesting, one of our chaplains visits a ship that has some Muslim people on it, crew. And he goes to that ship periodically. And the Muslim crew refer to him as pastor. I mean, he is their pastor. I mean, when they come into port, and they turn to him for needs that they have. So it's an interesting thing.
You might tell that story about the young man who was injured on ship and the role of hospitality of the place.
This is an example of how many times shipping companies attempt to avoid responsibility for things that happen on board ship. It is a kind of a law of the sea that a ship company must take responsibility for the needs of seafarers when they are injured or hurt or sick. I mean, that's just been a standard part of the law of the sea. And this young man was in from Ecuador, was on a ship over in New Jersey. The Port of New York now is actually in New Jersey, so we have to go to New Jersey for our ship visitation. And he had been, fell, injured his back, and was not able to work. Well, the company, the shipping company, was going to fly him back to Ecuador and get him out of the country as quickly as possible. Just by happenstance, he went out to JFK, and the flight was delayed or canceled, and he had to wait, so the airline had to put him up in a motel near the airport. Just by happenstance, the clerk at the hotel got to visiting with this fellow, happened to realize that what was happening to him, that he was being skirted out of the country quickly so that the company wouldn't have any responsibility for him. So he got in touch with the Seamen's Church Institute, which happens to have a Department of Seafarers' Rights, which is a legal department to help seafarers when they have legal difficulties. And they got in touch with us and said, would you put him up? So we put him up, and he was with us for about 6 months. While he was not only having medical treatment at the hospital nearby, we have several hospitals near our facility, and also they provided him with resources for his lodging and food. We actually gave him money every day for his food needs. So over a period of about 6 months that he was with us, he was getting legal assistance as well as medical assistance. Finally, he did get a settlement from the company. He was actually judged to be permanently injured and unable to continue as a seafarer. So he had a settlement of cash, I guess. So he was going to go back to Ecuador, use the money that he got out of the settlement to buy a taxi and be a taxi driver in Ecuador. So that's the kind of thing that can happen. And it happens periodically that we will have people come and stay with us where we give them not only accommodations but assistance in other ways while they are having medical and legal assistance. And one of the things...
There's a question.
Oh, yeah.
What's your financial basis?
Well, our base is basically because we have a 100-bed hotel.
Oh, okay.
And the seafarers pay well, a small fee. I mean, not a small fee. It's not as small as your fee. I think you have a very small fee. But they pay a moderate fee for a room in our place. And then other people stay with us who also pay for staying with us. So that becomes our primary source of support for our pastoral ministry that we carry on there. And we do get some money from our synod, a small, and then we have some donors, people who contribute directly to the ministry.
And
that
some
we,
grants through
and
the
some grants.
ILO.
Yeah. Yeah, we get money from the International Federation of Transport Workers Union, which is an international association or federation of all the unions of the transport workers unions of the world. It's based in England. And if you have a special need for instance, a few years ago, we had to put new windows in our building, and they gave us a grant of $85,000. You make an application for that. And the transport unions contribute to this international fund. So we can make application for that from time to time when we have special needs. They also provide us with our van. We have a van that goes to the chaplain uses when he goes to the port. That was given to us by the International Federation of Transport Workers Unions. And by that same token, then, we are required to use it. You know, when a ship is in port, he can take the crew to a shopping center or something like that to help them while they're in port to get things they need. Once in a while, we'll get a fax from a ship at sea, telling us that they're going to be coming into port on such and such a day, that's their anticipated arrival, and they have certain things they would like us to help them get that they can't get at the port. And so the chaplain then will go get those things, and then when the ship comes, he'll bring them to them. So it's very practical many times of what we're doing with them. So the International Federation of Transport Union work is an important part of our hospitality. I'm going to just pass these out. Why don't you pass those out so that you can each have a copy. I have some other things that I'll share with you, but I wanted to point out something in this most recent newsletter that we have here, which I think points up also the justice matters that we have to deal with in this kind of a field. If you'll open up to the first page, on the very bottom, it says, "May Day, May Day, May Day, the U.S. Merchant Marine is sinking." And thank you. And this is an example of a seafarer who is staying with us, who is seeing the changing circumstances in in the maritime world, where we have the problem of the reflagging of ships out of U.S. Flags and into other countries. And the problem is that the company, you can read this at your leisure, I call it to your attention, but the problem is that they are reflagging the ship so that they can hire foreign crews that are, you know, more exploitable than American shipping, American seafarers. And if you turn to the second page, the German Seamen's Mission now, we were hosted by the Germans in 1873 and for 20 years, Now we host the German Siemens Mission at our center in New York City. And you'll notice the news from the German Siemens Mission is citing the same problem that the German ships are having today. I mean, the German companies are reflagging to avoid the cost of operating in a German situation. So that's an example of the justice issues that are at work in the workplace ministry that we represent. Also, if you just notice over on the page 3, there is a picture there of why are these men smiling? And this is just a little indication of this pastoral ministry we do. And it also kind of hints a little bit at the reflagging of ships. These two men here are members of an all-Polish crew on a French-owned ship, but NASA-flagged vessel. Now I don't know if you understand what we're saying here, but here again, they are people who are willing to work at a lower wage and are therefore undercutting the seafarers. Many people that have made their life career at this and are now not able to find a job. We have many seafarers that come to our house now. They spend weeks looking for a job and they run out of money. And then we have to somehow or other kind of bankroll them for a few days sometimes until they get a job, then they pay us back. So we do have a kind of a loan arrangement with them.
Are they all men? Is it all men?
Not all men. There are some women, not as many women. Some of the women are radio operators. Some of them are engineers. Some of the women are engineers. And that's the reason we call ourselves seafarers rather than seamen. Mm-hmm. Now. But anyway, these two men from Poland, Chaplain Fenster, picked them up and brought them into New York. They had never been into New York before, so he brought them in and gave them a little exposure.
This issue doesn't show any pictures of women, which I complained about too.
Right.
But one of the German Siemens chaplain is a woman.
Yeah. We have two chaplains from the German Siemens mission, and one of the chaplains is a woman. So that's, maybe you have some questions about this ministry that would be of interest to you. I don't know.
I'm not sure. Is this kind of the outline what most Siemens ministries are in different ports? It sounds, it sounds like Seattle when you're talking about New York.
Yeah, right. It's pretty much the same. Yeah, mm-hmm, right. It's a ministry of visitation, pastoral visitation, a ministry of setting up a friendship with these people. As I say, in our situation, where we have a residence, a place, they come and will spend several days, sometimes several weeks. We've got 4 or 5 seafarers who are really retired. We're not a retirement center, but there's a camaraderie that we can create there and a sense of community. We have a chapel, and on Sundays we have services. We have the Eucharist every week in our chapel, and sometimes we have services during the week for special occasions. At Thanksgiving time, we have a Thanksgiving dinner. At Christmas time, we have a Christmas dinner. Primarily because many of the seafarers that are at our house have no home to go to. So we become kind of the family for them at those seasons of the year. We also have a project which is mentioned, I think, in here at the top of the third page about Christmas at sea. The women's organizations of our churches, of our Lutheran churches in New York and New Jersey, give us gifts each year, and we distribute about 1,000 gifts on board ship during December for the seafarers that are not able to be at home at Christmas time. So they have a Christmas party, and then they distribute the gifts that we brought on board ship.
And the people to whom you would be ministering, the seafarers, are international? Is that
mainly, right? Yeah. A lot of the people that come and stay with us are American seafarers, okay, because it's a little harder for the international seafarer to take time away and come to New York. Once in a while that happens.
Oh, okay.
Once in a while we'll have a ship handler who will have a crew. There will be a crew change. And they may fly in 15 Filipinos from someplace, and they house them at our house overnight, maybe for two or three nights, when there's a crew change. And so we do have, we'll have Filipino seafarers, for instance, once in a while. We have also had seafarers from the former Soviet Union stay with us because of crew changes. But normally they don't come on their own and stay with us because...
But American seafarers are also an international group. I mean, they come from different backgrounds.
Oh, yeah. We have people from all different backgrounds. And there are several seafaring ministries in New York. The Church of Sweden has one. The Church of Norway has one. The Danish Church has one. The Seamen's Church Institute, which is the Episcopal Church, has one. I mean, our port is so big, we need more than just one ministry. So we and it's very ecumenical. We certainly respect one another and work together in a very collaborative manner. If one of the chaplains from one of the other ministries can't go on board a ship and there's some special need, they'll call and ask us if we would take care of that situation.
In addition, you are welcome to experience the hospitality of seafarers when you're in New York, because you're staying there, if there is room available, helps support the ministry.
Yeah.
So you can pick up...
Yeah, I have some information here.
About that here, yeah. And other things. One last area of hospitality that is a frontier these days, and particularly so as we in the U.S. become more conscious of persons with disabilities, is the area of hospitality to people who have special needs, either physical or mental needs. And a lot of work has been done by the religious community and by others in concert around issues of hospitality for people with disabilities. And the Americans with Disabilities Act requires us to do certain things, making facilities hospitable.
Except the churches
are exempt. The churches are exempt from the ADA, which means that the churches...
Not totally true.
Yeah, you're right about that. And that will change over time as well.
If they receive funds from the government. Mm-hmm.
Or if you make a new construction.
Right. That's true.
By the ADA.
But, I mean, we're not required at this point to modify our facilities under the law, which secular and our organizations are required at this point.
But a lot of work has been done, and Dave, having lived for 47 years with a... 47, 48 years physical challenge, has had some interest in that. So you might want to talk just... very briefly about some of the materials.
Well, I might just mention these. There's so many things you could go into at this point. It's a whole presentation on its own, but we thought we would just mention it. What's her name?
Jenny Thornburg.
Yeah, the wife of the former
Attorney General under a previous administration.
Yeah, has a great interest in this because they have a child who is mentally retarded, so she has developed a whole set of materials. One is called That All May Worship, an Interfaith Welcome to People with Disabilities, and the Loving Justice, the ADA, and the Religious Community. These two books are available. And then there's a new one that's just coming out, which you have noted in your
From Barriers to Bridges, which is a new one that she's publishing. She has just taken on this as a personal campaign and has engaged others in the religious community to work with her on developing these resources.
We've come a long way, haven't we?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm very much aware of it, even here. I mean, the things that they've done here, making it more accessible, which I think... I was here in 1961, and I was younger then, and I was able to even get up on the back end of the truck. I was disabled at that time, and I was just able to kind of wander around a little bit and see the place at that point. But, I mean, it's wonderful that they've done what they have here, I think. And so that's been very positive and encouraging to see. So I appreciate that. Another thing is just the whole matter of disability etiquette. This is a little pamphlet that we got this last spring at a conference in New York. I mean, the Open Congregation and the Eastern Paralyzed Veterans Organization collaborate every year on a conference, this is a pamphlet that, if you're interested, I only have one, but it sort of gives you just interacting with people with disabilities, how you relate to them and so forth. I think more and more as people with disabilities become more open about getting into the public light, you're going to run into more of them, and how do you relate to people like that? You know, I have people often that are, I think people are getting more sensitive, and they're more able to deal with you just as in a normal kind of natural way. But that learning that, I think, is kind of a part of one's attitudinal as well as practical way of living with people who are disabled. So if you have any interest in any of that, you can get some more information.
Curiosity question. Uh-huh. How long ago was it where, at least in a number of our churches, mm-hmm. people with certain disabilities could not be ordained?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, you know, it's interesting. I was ordained in 56.
Yeah.
And I remember going through the colloquy of our church, which was, we in the Augustana church, you had to appear before the committee of faculty and also the Synod, as we called them then, conference presidents. And I can remember Malvin Lundeen was the chair of the committee that I went in and had this interview with. And he had a son who had polio. I had polio back in the late 40s. He had a son who became a doctor. And I remember him raising that issue with me. He said, how do you expect to, you know, manage in the ministry if go out? And I think I responded something to the effect, maybe I could be even more sensitive to people's needs by having had some, you know, experience of my own that was challenging. I think I had enough sense to say that to him even then.
I think, I'm not sure how many, but I think of two in my time. Mm-hmm. One was Alan Lee, who, so he was an evangelist, mm-hmm. but he couldn't be a pastor.
Yeah.
And I don't think that Dar Roa was ordained either. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Just a terrible.
Yeah, I think there was a time when that was
right.
was really a closed door. That's for right. people with disabilities.
Yeah.
I think that it's opening more now.
I think the Roman Catholic Church has even changed its rule.
Yeah.
You know, they use the Old Testament passage about Melchizedek. You know, no blemish, that type of a thing. Nobody could have a blemish, as if somehow or other, you know, people could walk or see and all didn't have any blemishes. I mean, most of us have some kind of a weak spot. And I think in the 80s, even that rule changed in the Roman Catholic Church, so you could be ordained if you have a disability.
One of the delights of living in New York is that Dave serves on the disability program for people with disabilities at Lincoln Center, a committee for increasing accessibility of the arts. And the honorary chairperson of that group is Itzhak Perlman, whose music, as you may know, comes from the violin, a violinist. But performs out of a major physical challenge, having braces on both legs, and has. You may not know that if you haven't seen him in concert, but he is physically challenged and just
very humorous guy. You probably
wonderful.
Seen him on television if
yeah.
you haven't seen him in person.
Then think how things are covered up in terms of Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Right, right, exactly.
Oh. Yeah, I think that there's been a remarkable change. I have to say that. At Lincoln Center, when we first went to New York, I had told the bishop that, you know, I'd been in a parish ministry for 30 years, and I'd like to take a year or so, just kind of get acclimated. And so I used that first year, really, to just do